Okay, thank you, Jackie, and thank you, John, for inviting me to come speak today. Just a quick question. How many of you have heard of green roof technology, just by show of hands? Okay, good number of you. Okay, good. So I was asked to come talk about prospects for biodiversity in urban areas through green roof technology. I'm a landscape architect. I worked in Chicago for a number of years, since 1999, working with green roofs. So my experience comes from seeing the green roof movement evolve here in North America. I want to start with just the concept that a green roof is really a synthetic habitat, completely contrived, engineered. I mean, this may be obvious, but when you're up at the top of a roof, on the left, there's an image of a native prairie in the Chicago region, and on the top right is the Chicago City Hall. If you're walking around, you see birds, butterflies, crickets. It looks like an ecosystem, but down below is a completely contrived ecosystem. And this technology is developed centrally in Germany over a number of years, actually since the 1970s, a little bit earlier. So they've perfected the substrate design so that these types of meadow systems can thrive and continually evolve. So there are some parallels between the two different substrates. Obviously, you have a vegetation layer. I think over time you see some duff or just old plant material left there, so you may get some sort of a development of some organic matter on the top that becomes cycled into the substrate. When the green roof substrate goes on, it's entirely uniform, okay, all the way across. So there's really no development of the substrate, and we're using expanded minerals. So the substrate is designed to maintain its structure at a consistent level over time. And the B horizon essentially takes place at the filter fabric that holds the soil in place. It prevents the fine materials from going down the drain. Okay, so you do have some accumulation of fine silt materials, maybe some clays, different things on that fabric. And then down below that, you have drainage. So you have some of the same functions as a natural ecosystem, but it's all completely contrived. It's an engineered system. Okay, so on the top, here's a photograph of a cut-through section of a green roof. I'm going to talk just a little bit about the importance of these materials. On top of the waterproofing root barrier, you would find a water management protective blanket. It's a fabric. It's a non-organic fabric. It's a polypropylene type material. It's typically a thick blanket, and it slows water down. It holds moisture in place, also protects the membrane from becoming damaged. There are a couple different materials for drainage for green roofs. John spoke about the expanded shales. There are many different materials you could use, expanded clay, shale, slate. Some people are using pumice out on the West Coast. So local materials can become used for drainage. Also, there have been developed a number of plastic or synthetic drainage sheets. So the granular materials are a very good analog for a prairie-type green roof or a meadow system, and these plastic drainage sheets are very good for Xeric-type green roofs. So green roofs that are using succulent plants that need a very dry substrate, otherwise the plants will not thrive. And then there's a non-woven polypropylene fabric on the top, which you can see on the top image. It's very typically a much thinner fabric, and its job is really to hold the soil in place. And then the growth media is typically composed of about 35-60% lightweight aggregate, 25-50% sand, coarse sand, up to 15% silt, and organic matter is typically held low. And this information is coming from the German FLL guidelines, which I'll talk about in a bit. And sometimes, if you're trying to establish plants on top of the green roof, as opposed to pre-established plants being brought up in modules, there will be a biodegradable blanket that will hold that media in place. Wind can be a significant problem on rooftops, so you want to hold that lightweight material in place. And then the vegetation varies for the design. You can design a green roof to manage stormwater, to manage urban heat islands, for wildlife, many different purposes. So I think the design order goes by selecting your habitat type that you want to create on the rooftop, and then all the components below become essentially selected to support that type of vegetative system. Okay, so green roof technology has been around in Europe for quite some time. In North America, I like to describe it as the wild, wild west. Okay, it's still very volatile industry. You have a lot of people coming onto the market selling many different types of green roof vendor-provided systems. And unfortunately, not all green roofs remain green. And I think some of this is just due to the lack of knowledge of the resources that are out there to develop substrates for green roofs. As early as the 1980s in North America, Theodore Osmundson had been designing roof gardens. In his book, classic book, Roof Gardens, he specifies several different projects where he had problems with substrates. He didn't have knowledge of the European-based green roof systems, and so he saw a lot of slumping of soils. There was nothing structurally to hold the soil in place, so organic matter would decompose over time. You would see maybe a 12-inch substrate dropping down to 10 or 8 inches, which wreaks havoc on the whole green roof system. Then there are also other problems that have related more like structural. If we go down to Patrick Carey, he's a writer for greenroofs.com. He did a paper or an article on plant failures, and it's due to the media blends. Okay, he's wrote about 4 or 5 projects where there have been problems with green roofs. Here in Texas, I know personally of at least one project. There have been some problems. It was a custom design blend. Probably the most well-known documentation of problems is this Shackford paper here presented at Green Roofs for Healthy Cities a few years back. This green roof on the right is designed by a German team that has come here to the U.S. to help implement the technology here. Okay, in Brooklyn, New York, there were several projects that all went in at the same time, including their design. So for this investigation, they came back 2 years later to look at the green roof systems and how well they're functioning. Okay, well, you see variations from just gravel with a few plants patchy to some level of support of plants. So there was a lot of variety within the degree of success of the green roofs. And for them, it really is no secret. They just applied what is being used in Germany in terms of the soil recipes, and they made some minor adjustments here to get their system to work. So some of the outcomes, I'm sorry, it's Bronx, outcomes of this study. The first one is that you should use a green roof provider that has a 5-year record of success. Okay, there are a lot of experimental type systems out there, so you want to have some proven results that it works or evidence that the substrate is being designed with the FLL guidelines. Another outcome was just the use of this fabric. Okay, if that protection fabric is not there, the water, the moisture can move off the roof much quicker, so it won't hang around, so that it's not available to the plants. And then also, as well, they recommend FLL-compliant growing media. Now, it's not that we don't have standards here in the U.S. We do. We have some in place. We have some in work in the process, but they haven't been approved yet at this time. Okay, so assuming that you have a healthy green roof and it's designed, the potential benefits for urban areas are really quite astounding if you look at the diversity of benefits. Reduction of stormwater runoff, 50 to 86% annually, depending on the design. Reduction of water temperature running off a rooftop. If you look at a black bituminous roof versus a green roof, the water coming off will be much cooler. And I highlighted this as an area for future research. We really don't, there aren't any papers that identify that intuitive knowledge. So I think this is one area, as well as the quality, water quality. Okay, there have been a few studies looking at leachate, but since there's no real standard agreement of what types of organic matter can be used on green roofs, I think this is another area that needs a lot of research. Peak reduction of peak discharge runoff, building energy needs reduction 10 to 30%. Building temperature, surface temperature cooling by up to 45 degrees compared to black bituminous dark roofs. Reduction in noise pollution. Okay, this is something that people often don't think of, but if you apply these green roofs in like areas surrounding airports or hospitals area where you need to control sound, the monetary benefits and reduction of waste of tearing off roof membranes. You can extend the life of a roof 2 to 3 times. Carbon sequestration and reduction of air pollution. There are a few studies out there, but this is an area for, I think, significant looking into this quite a bit, because I think green roofs can play a significant role in helping to clean urban area. And wildlife. We'll look at this a little bit in just a moment here. I think green roofs also engage people with the environment, okay? Particularly if you're looking down on a rooftop, it can really enliven the space. You can watch the activity of animals in different various forms. So the modern green roofs we work with today really have a long history going back to Germany in the late 1800s. Bituminous roofs were a newly invented material for waterproofing rooftops. There was also a great concern for preserving buildings through fire. Okay, if there's a fire in an urban area, you might have embers that are floating around in the air, land on a rooftop, and ignite it. So this roofer, H. Koch, developed a gravel and sand ballasted roof to prevent the spread of fire. Okay, so you change the habitat, you change the inhabitants, right? You have sand and gravel, it's holding moisture. There's a continuous supply of seed, ambient seed, floating in the air. So these spontaneous roofs started showing up all over Germany in the turn of the century. There's a botanist, Reinhard Borkum, who had a completely different research agenda, but his office overlooked one of these spontaneous roofs. He became enamored by the diversity of plant materials that were growing on these, and so he abandoned his current research and started looking at green roof vegetation. 37 rooftops later, bringing a number of graduate students along with him, he essentially became the pioneer of the green roof industry of what we know today. And then the modern expanded substrates that are used on green roofs, they were developed more in the 1980s. Okay. One of the outcomes of this work in Germany is the FLL guidelines. They are published now in English for the first time in 2002. You can purchase these online, a PDF version. It's about $25. And what's important here for us is that they have at least 3 chapters that focus on the substrate. There's a lot of detail in this document that describes the components, the mineral components, the granulometric distribution, drainage characteristics, and filtering materials used for green roofs. So I just published a paper this year looking at the knowledge domains in the FLL compared to what we have for North America. Okay, where are we in terms of getting an adjustment? So I came up with 7 different areas, including systems design, structural, waterproofing, drainage, growth media, vegetation, and maintenance. Okay, so in this paper, I identified over here a direct comparison between standards that are found and guidelines in FLL versus what we have available in North America. So in FLL, they'll tell you exactly the different depths of substrate for different families or categories of plants, of life forms, as well as the different materials that can be used, the granulometric distribution, the grain size, organic content, salt, pH, nutrient values. So a lot of detail in terms of how you actually design a substrate that works with a green roof. We don't have anything like that yet published in North America that is comparable, that can be used by a city, municipality. The federal government has this whole building design guideline that is really just a skeleton of FLL. ASTM currently has a 33-page green roof systems document that has not been approved yet, but we're looking for that to come out in the next couple of years that will help address this lack of knowledge. In terms of standard practices, in Germany, they actually come back to a green roof after 3 years and 5 years. They do a number of different tests. If we look down here, they test for granulometric distribution, density, water movement, air, pH, salt. Okay, so it gets a checkup after 3 years and 5 years to see how the substrate is supporting the vegetation. Okay, so we really don't have anything like that here. So in terms of areas for opportunity for research, we're really just beginning to understand how to design green roofs. So this is straight out of FLL. After about 30 years of research, they determined that a substrate design that has this range of composition for extensive green roofs, these are the drought-tolerant type green roofs, that this is their range of successful design. Okay, it's basically composed of small gravel, coarse sand, and some fine sand, very little silt, if any. So if your media is much coarser than this, it may not be able to support plant life because there's not enough moisture. If it's tighter than this, too many fine particles, then there's not adequate drainage and it can clog fabrics and become problematic. Roof gardens, okay, they can be designed and they really need some of this silt content here, so that would be an intensive green roof. Different substrate depths for different plant communities. This is again an FLL. So a grass roof really needs 6 to 8 inches depth for supporting that type of vegetation, where the succulents anywhere between 2 to 4 inches in or 5 inches in Germany. So we don't have a table like this for North America, but the different ecological regions, we need to figure out, okay, what are the different optimal depths of substrates for different types of plant communities. With my co-author, we looked at different ecoregions in North America, what type of plant research is out there. Michigan State, Brad Rowe, has done a phenomenal job in doing research on green roofs. He's produced a lot. Jeremy Lundholm is now also doing some incredible work. He's an ecologist. Other than that, if you look at all the different ecoregions, there's only one or two studies representing this. So the field is wide open in terms of trying to understand what is important for supporting plants. Now, some of the findings we found out, okay, people are figuring out different substrate depths. Boven in 2001 found that succulents, particularly sedum, need at least 4 inches to survive the winters. Okay, if they're shallower than that, then the roots tend to freeze and they won't survive. I'm going to skip through this, go on to ecological findings. The list of papers is even scanter. There's very few publications in terms of biodiversity on green roofs. Reed Kaufman has published a few papers. Jeremy Lundholm has probably done the most work in terms of looking at biodiversity on green roofs. Lundholm found, well, he essentially identified 29 natural habitats with ecological implications. So these are things like short grass prairie or a glade habitat that we could look at as a template for green roof vegetation that may work with a few additional resources, such as irrigation or nitrogen. And Lundholm is also looking at insects. Over 200 species collected are found on a green roof over a period of time in this study, 2009-2010. So here's the list of where ASTM is at the moment. Okay, there's a guide for vegetation. Okay, we can figure out what the drainage rate, how it works, or what the drainage rate could be for a green roof, so if you want to design one. But we don't have any guidelines that say what it should be for various types of green roof systems. So we're really just starting to understand how green roofs can be applied here. New prospects. Urban agriculture in New York City is really moving forward with urban agriculture on rooftops. This is Earth Pledge. They have a vegetable garden up top that is maintained in part through homeless, who they also eat some of the produce, so they're actively involved and engaged with urban agriculture. Then there's a 6,000 square foot organic vegetable farm in Brooklyn, producing food, which is sold down below. I haven't found any research at all in terms of what the requirements are for substrate design for these types of systems or how they perform over time. So this is an area that is wide open for research. You know, one person would wonder, like, well, what about nutrient leaching and how do you maintain this, you know, how do these systems work? Okay, we really don't know much about this. Wildlife habitat. Dusty Gage has done some really interesting work in the UK looking at designing habitat for the threatened or endangered black redstart. Okay, he calls these brown roofs. Okay, the black redstart is losing this habitat as buildings develop and essentially displace these urban meadows or fields. The redstart needs this habitat. So they're just throwing this gravel, rocky gravel and soil mix up on the top along with these branches, twigs, and they allow it to be populated by the spontaneous vegetation. So there's not a lot of design. I'm not sure how these function long term. I have not seen any research on this, but they're very effective at creating habitat for this species. One of the things that he's promoting is varying the thickness of the substrate as opposed to keeping a uniform depth all the way through. So this allows for more diversity in the substrate for both plants and insects below. Wish I had more time to talk about this project. This is really amazing. This was built in 1914. This is a water filtration plant in Switzerland, where underneath they're treating water coming from Lake Zurich. Originally it was a black bituminous rooftop, but it heated up so much it also started to affect the water quality below. So they threw a bunch of gravel and sand on the top and they just let it go. Okay. Well, some years later, it's not a very, very well drained roof. So there's now a mesic wetland on the rooftop. 170 different species, including 9 species of orchids, one of which is endangered. And the site is now a proposed National Heritage Conservation Site on a rooftop. Okay, it's pretty amazing to think about rooftops becoming a place to preserve plant communities. Germany, of course, they're really pushing this technology. Now they're this John Deere Works in Mannheim. They produced a wetland system on the top of the green roof to remove phosphates, some heavy metals that are they had previously been sending out into the sewer system. Well, in Germany, they have laws where they have to pay money for water that comes off of their property. So they're becoming very innovative in terms of how do you remove these nutrients and things from the roof. So it's a 2-inch deep hydroponic system, and they're now doing research on, I guess, the effectiveness of the plants to remove these systems. And if you look at very dense cities like anywhere in Japan and parts of Asia, the urban areas are becoming green. Okay, so I think this is the future. We need to figure out how to design these systems. So a few recommendations: work with these FLL guidelines, and then compare your performance results with this, so we have some base of understanding of how to interpret the results, right? Some people are working with composites of these expanded materials and native soils. We really need to figure out how this can work and if it can work without clogging the materials there. Work with interdisciplinary groups, different forms of plants. Some people are stuck on sedums but really need to look at different life forms. And I'll just end with, I think green roof technology, like many of these things, these bioengineering tools, become regionally adapted. So we may have a national standard, but it needs to be pushed towards ecoregions so we can understand the plant communities there. And with that, I will come to a conclusion. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much.